This is the third day of the retreat. Some of you who are leaving this evening, this is the last day to get enlightened. So for those of you who are more slow, you have to stay another few days. But keeping like a nice sense of humour, keeping light-hearted, you'll find if you're light-hearted, the heart has a chance to float higher and higher into the rarefied atmosphere of deep meditations. So if you're very heavy and very serious, then sometimes you're just too tense, too tight, and you can't really get into the deep meditations. In fact, that sort of heaviness is one of the obstacles to deep meditation, which I'm going to be talking about in this morning's talk. These morning talks, I'm giving very clear, methodical explanations about meditation, how to do it, and what stages you should go for. But in today's talk, I'm going to specifically talk about the obstacles to meditation, and of course, how to overcome them. So this is what you should look out for. If you find your meditation isn't going well, or there's some problem there, it's an obstacle. And you should find out exactly what the obstacle is and apply the remedy. Just like a good doctor would look at a person and find out what's right with them when they're sick. I have to remember what I was saying last night. What's right with them when they're sick. Find out what the cause is and see if they can do something to eliminate that cause, and so they can be in health again. In Buddhism, in meditation, we're talking about something which is been a part of that religion for 25 centuries, and all the obstacles are very well known, all the remedies have been well worked out. These aren't new diseases which come up in the mind to stop you meditating. These are the old, well-worn tracks of wrong perceptions, wrong ideas which stop you achieving deep states of meditation. And that's why the traditional formula of the five hindrances is still a very adequate and very beautiful way of describing what the hindrances to meditation are, the obstacles are, and also how to overcome them. So when I'm talking about obstacles, it's in terms of the five hindrances. Many of you would have heard those five hindrances said before. In brief, they are sensory desire, ill will, they are restlessness and remorse, sloth and torpor, and the last one is doubt. As I'll explain these hindrances to you, this is not coming from theory, this is how these hindrances actually work in the mind and why they stop you from getting into deep meditation. So listen carefully and also listen to the remedy for these hindrances, because when you have an obstacle, it's very good to look at that obstacle and find out which hindrance is it. Or which combination of hindrances is it? So you understand what the problem is, and then apply the remedy. And you'll find your meditation, being more methodical, more careful, will go much more deeper with less problems, with less messing around. It's the nature of the mind to go deep. These are the problems which stop you going deep. Identify them and know what to do. So the first of the hindrances, sensory desire, is much more the first problem of sensory desire is much more than just thinking about the lunch later on. It's much more than sort of lust, thinking about a beautiful girl or a handsome boy or whatever. It's much more than the coarser forms of sensory desire. It's how this actually manifests in your meditation. Is very often when you're overly concerned about the comfort of this body. Sometimes when you're meditating, this body has got too many aches and too many pains. You can never get it comfortable. I've been mentioning this very often in the last couple of days, that the search for comfort in the body is an endless task. No matter how you position your body, it will never be fully comfortable, because sensory desire is always going out looking for something to disturb the mind. Really, it's not that the knees disturb you. The truth of the matter is you go out to disturb the knees. You go out to disturb the throat if you've got a cough. You'd go out to disturb the weather. You want the window open, you want the window closed. It's you actually going out to seek for something to distract yourself. This obsession with something to do, this obsession for trying to make things more and more comfortable, more and more secure, is what basically drives our world. Drives it to get bigger and bigger houses, more and more air conditioners, heaters, more and more different foods, more comfortable ways of making that food, softer beds, softer chairs, more conveniences, more conveniences, more conveniences. So these days, if you want to watch the television, we don't need even just to get out of the chair. Soon will be the case, we'll have robots. You just sit in the chair all day, and we press the robot for some curry. We press the robot for something to eat, or a cup of tea. You just sit in the chair all day. And if you sit in the chair all day, it's very, very uncomfortable. So that search for comfort, search for convenience, only leads actually to more trouble. In our meditation, sometimes that we're just watching the present moment or being with the breath, and sometimes something in the body comes to disturb us. Or rather, we, if you look very carefully with mindfulness, we get restless and we go looking. How's the knees now? How's the throat now? How's the ears now? How's the temperature outside? If you really were satisfied and content with your meditation object, you wouldn't go out looking at the body and you wouldn't get disturbed by this body. That first hindrance of sensory desire is the desire for comfort in this body, not just for pleasure but for the ending of discomfort. Sensory desire, the hindrance of sensory desire, is what makes you scratch your nose when it itches, what makes you sort of move your back just to get it, try and get it comfortable. Even what makes you just move your head from backwards to forwards, just trying to get it comfortable. That is sensory desire. It's trying to find some comfort in the world of the five senses of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. And after a while you realize it's endless and there's no peace for you in that, following that path. However, the way to overcome that sensory desire, the way to actually let go of the body so it's not disturbing you anymore, I've already mentioned, you have to gently let go of the body, stage by stage. The body is the five senses. The five senses are the body. Sometimes that people say that our body, so our five senses are here to protect the body. But I've looked at this for many years and see that it's the other way around. The whole purpose of this body is to give a vehicle so the five senses can play around in the world, can enjoy the world. Otherwise, if the five senses were there to protect the body, they would never let you go on these adventure rides where you get twirled upside down 3 or 4 times a minute, or go to these death drops in these new adventure playgrounds, or go white water rafting or bungee jumping. These are just done to stimulate those senses, to give them something to do. And here we're realizing this is a hindrance to the meditation. Realize the reason why it's a hindrance to meditation, because these deep meditation states are all about letting go of this body, detaching from this body, allowing it to disappear. And I'm sure that there have been times for each of you when this body has disappeared or almost disappeared. And it's great fun, a great sense of peace, as if a great irritation, burden has been dropped, and you feel so much more free. The way to overcome that hindrance of sensory desire is like through the wisdom of knowing that the five senses can never give you peace, never give you tranquility, they can never give you satisfaction. And secondly, that you calm those senses through this process of letting go stage by stage by taking away attention. The more attention you give to this body, the more it disturbs you. For example, Just look at the feeling of saliva in your mouth now. Can you feel the saliva in your mouth? Maybe before I mentioned that it wasn't a problem. Now it is. As soon as you give attention to it, it's a disturbance. It's going to take a while now. You've actually got to forget it. And then it disappears and it's not a problem anymore. In our meditation, we have to actually focus on something else instead of the saliva in our throat. We have to focus somewhere else except on our body. Because when we start focusing on our body, there's always some demand from this body. It's always too tired, or it's always too hot, or it's too cold. Now, can you really, even if those of you who've got air conditioners in your house, is it really ever the right temperature? It's always a little bit too hot or a little bit too cold. That's why you have to keep on adjusting it all the time. Eating. Is there ever an end to this eating? You just had breakfast. How long is that going to satisfy you? Another couple of hours, you want lunch. Another couple of hours, you want dinner. Some people like to have tea. Some people like to have a snack in the middle of the night. It's endless putting food in this body. It's endless drinking. It's endless scratching. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you can just scratch once and that would it? You wouldn't need to scratch ever again. Or if you had some sort of pill, you could put it in the body and that was it for a lifetime. It would just slowly release proteins and minerals and everything else. So you never have to eat ever and ever and ever again. Unfortunately, that doesn't work like that. So the only way you can get freedom from this body is through inattention to this body. So said, the first hindrance of sensory desire is gained through inattention, letting go stage by stage, which is why you teach in this particular way past and future. Most of the past and future is concerning basically this body, how I can get it happy and comfortable, and sometimes in a very convoluted way, how I can get money to make this body comfortable by having a better house or by being so rich that I don't need to go to work any morning so I can sleep in bed rather than having to go to work on the trams. Whatever it is, to try and give yourself more comfort in this body. Much of the thinking of the past and future is all about that. This is five senses. Much of the thoughts are all about these five senses. How you can get more pleasure, how you can get rid of the problems of these five senses. Just letting go of past and future, letting go of thinking, is getting rid of a lot of the body. In that silence, much of the body has disappeared. So often, even like pain, physical pain, I've already mentioned, so much of that is made of thought. I tell this story in Perth quite often about one of the people in our monastery who's got very bad teeth. And so that he's instead of having anaesthetic, he always tries to find dentists who won't give him anaesthetic when they pull his teeth out. He's only got one doctor who will do that in Perth. And so yes, he's well known throughout the whole dental faculty in Perth. But this one doctor who will pull his teeth out without anaesthetic lives quite a long way from the monastery. And that's really quite a long way to go. So he came to another solution, to pull his own teeth out. And we saw him once with the freshly pulled out tooth in a pair of pliers which he got from the workshop. I love stories like this. And we asked him, how did he do that? And this little story, I say, how he pulled out his own teeth, is very illustrative of what I'm talking about, of how pain is mostly thought. He said when he decided to pull his own teeth out, it didn't hurt. When he walked to the workshop, it still didn't hurt. When he picked up the pliers, there was no pain then. Even when he put the pliers on the tooth, there was still no pain, didn't hurt at all. And when he wiggled that tooth backwards and forwards, it hurt for about 5 seconds, that's all. And after it was out, it didn't hurt. There's only 5 seconds of pain, that's all. That's not much. Now, if that was you, even before you picked up that pliers, it'd already be hurting. Even just me telling you, it's already hurting, isn't it? And you just see how much the mental part of that story makes it pain. It's what we think about it makes it painful, not the actual experience. And that's why that most of the concerns with the physical body lie in the realm of thought. If you stop thinking about it, it doesn't hurt so much. In fact, it hardly hurts at all. Most of the pain lies in the thought. So those of you who can develop silence during this retreat, you'll find it's very wonderful if ever you get into deep physical pain or sickness. If you can get into that silence, you'll find that most of the difficulty is gone. But beyond that silence, we've still got the awareness of the discomforts in the body, the heat and the cold or whatever else. This is why that we go from being aware of all of the senses in silence, the senses of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, to actually go into one sense, just the sense of touch with the breath. That's why this breath meditation is a very powerful way of leading you into the emptiness of the senses. From five senses we go to one sense of physical touch just with the breath. Remember that simile I gave yesterday of the eye of the bird and the students having to shoot their arrow through that eye? You focus just on one part of these senses, after a while all the other senses disappear. All you have is the breath, and even sounds outside disappear. One of the reasons why that's a beautiful state, a happy state, naturally, is because it's free from all these irritations of sensory concern with sounds. No taste or smells anymore. No concern with physical body. Only just this little bit of the breath. That's why you find that the aches and pains disappear when you get to the stage of the beautiful breath. When I was in Thailand the first year, when I got to Ajahn Chah's monastery, they hadn't even started this international monastery, Wat Nanachat. So I was one of the first monks there. And we had to sleep out under the trees again in Wat Nanachat. It was just a forest, just a bit of jungle. And because it was a monastery which was just beginning, Ajahn Chah actually came to stay there. And because he was there, all these villagers would come every evening to do some chanting and to meditate under the trees. There was no hall. And as you know, in the jungle, in the evening time, that's when all the mosquitoes come out. That's why when all these mosquitoes were coming out, we would do the chanting on loving kindness. You know the chant which you're supposed to do, may all beings be happy and well, may all beings be free from suffering. But I found myself doing, may all beings except mosquitoes be happy and well. May all beings except mosquitoes be free from suffering, because I hated these mosquitoes. They were giving me so much trouble, because you're a Westerner just from fresh from England, and you weren't used to things biting you. That wasn't English to do such that. And it was very hard to endure. There was no mosquito repellent. There was no mosquito coils. This was backwards Thailand 26 years ago. You just had to sit there and endure. And the mosquitoes in Thailand, probably Sri Lanka as well, they'd be genetically bred to know that monks are a safe lunch. Be careful anyone with hair on, because they might swat you. But as a monk, so they'll be absolutely safe. Not only that, but monks have got more exposed skin, especially with a bald head, and we usually just have our shoulders uncovered. So there's all this lovely area to feed on. So when these mosquitoes were biting you, it was just so hard to meditate. And so, with another monk who was also about the same age as me, just freshly ordained, we used to count the mosquitoes on our arms and our head. And he usually got to about 40 or 50, I'm not joking, and they were so close together that you couldn't actually distinguish them anymore, you couldn't actually count how many were actually on you. All you could hear was this slurp, slurp, slurp of your blood. No, you couldn't hear the slurp, you did actually get so many mosquitoes on you. And it was great, because they taught me a lot about meditation. Because the only way that I could overcome that problem, no mosquito repellent, no coils, and of course you wanted to run, but no, Ajahn Chah was there. And worse, but all these villagers were there. All these simple ties, and I got a university degree, and I couldn't be outdone by these people. My pride kept me there, kept me from running. Silly pride, but it helped at that moment. The only way I could overcome that problem was actually to really watch the breath and let go of my body. And that's what I used to do every evening. Just when you started the meditation, you went straight onto the breath, and you never let it go. Because every time I let my attention move away from my breath, it would go to my arm or my head where these mosquitoes were biting. And that was unendurable. So I went into some nice meditations there. The strange thing actually happened. Not only did you stop feeling your body, it was like the body completely disappeared, but also I found out afterwards that once you got into deep meditation, the muscles didn't bite you anymore. Because you'd look at the skin afterwards and there'd be no bumps. Because, you know, usually when a mossy bit you, that you'd always have a little red mark, a little welt or a little bump there somewhere. But in meditation, there's not even any bumps there. I found out afterwards that one of the reasons why mosquitoes bite you is because of the carbon dioxide or monoxide, which is secreted from the body by the metabolism, and the heat of that and the smell of that actually attracts the mossies. And in deep meditation, metabolism goes right down. You get so calm and so still, but actually the mosquitoes think you're not there. So there's actually a proper effect there. But the nice thing was that because I'd taken my attention away from the body, you couldn't feel anything. You felt so free and so light of escaping from the mozzies that way. And I thank the mosquitoes for that, for actually teaching me and helping me really get into my meditation. Because I couldn't afford to have the mind wandering onto the body, because it hurt too much. And so ever since then you realise you can do it, if you really have to, if you really want to, you can let go of the whole body with all its aches and pains and get into some nice deep meditation. So this is letting go of the body. You go from all the five senses to one sense, just the breath. And if you calm that down, even that sense disappears and you've completely let go of the body. The time that you know you've overcome that hindrance of sensory concern is when the body is completely gone and you're left with the mind. And that stage is either when a nimitta arises and you're with that nimitta, or when you're in the full jhanas. That's a sign that first hindrance has been completely overcome. When you can let go of this body. When we talk in Buddhism about attachment, people talk about all sorts of silly ideas about attachment. They've even got that joke about why are Buddhist houses always dirty in the corners? Because their vacuum cleaner has no attachments. It's a silly joke, isn't it? Because this is not what we really mean by attachments. What we mean by attachments is like things we can't let go of. And if we can't let go of our body, that's why we call it attachment. And this is actually where we're seeing whether we can let go of this body or not. Just in meditation, you put it down on the cushion, on the chair, and let it go. What you let go of disappears, separates from the knower. We don't pick it up again. If you can do that, you can also learn how to let go of your body when you're about to die. Because that's what you have to do at that stage of your journey through samsara. You have to let go of this body. And this is training for that. So if this body is still worrying you, concerning you, if you've got aches and pains, itches or whatever, you can never get comfortable in your meditation. It's nothing to do with the body. This is sensory concern. It's the first hindrance. You do not need to be fully healthy and to be absolutely fit, because no one is fully healthy. No one is fully fit. We're all at different stages of disease. Some more advanced than others. But we've all got diseases in us. We're all getting older, we're all getting sick, we're all close to death. So, don't try and get rid of this disease in the body. Don't try and make it perfect. It's good enough as it is, with all the aches and pains. Even sometimes in deep pain, you can meditate very, very well. If you can let go of your sensory concern, the body, let the body look after the body. You're going to let it go. The second hindrance is ill will. And that ill will can be to three things. The most common understanding of ill will is ill will to somebody else, usually this person sitting next to you, or maybe your husband, your wife. It's amazing just how much ill will is to people who are really close to us. I always used to say in the monastery, because in a Buddhist monastery we sit according to the number of years we've been in the robes. So that if you ordain just a couple of days after someone else, you're sitting next to them for life. And it's amazing that they can either be your best friend or your worst enemy. You just kind of get away from them. So much of the arguments or the personality problems in a monastery is always with the person sitting next to you. It's the same in life. Most of the ill will is towards the people you love, you're close to. I'm sure that many of you who are married, who've been married for many years, you've probably been more angry at your husband or at your wife than anybody else. It's just the closeness gives rise to friction. But that's an ill will which, you know, we talked about many times. The way to overcome that is through loving kindness. But you can't practice loving kindness to someone when they're right close to you. There's an old beautiful saying in Chinese, to love the tiger but at a distance. It's a lovely saying because what it means is to practice loving kindness. If you're angry at someone, really upset at them, it's not the right time to practice loving kindness. If you haven't practiced it before, you can't do it then. The only way to practice loving kindness to your enemies is when they're not there, when they're a long distance away. When you're feeling content, when you're feeling at ease, then you find it's reasonably easy to practice loving kindness when they're not a problem, an immediate problem. So if your enemy is away, that's the time to practice loving kindness. You practice, 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 and it's very easy then, or much easier, to change the perception around from ill will to a bit of forgiveness. And then if you practice at a distance, when you do meet the tiger, because you've already practiced, then just what's been developed in your heart will be what will come forward. You will be able to give loving kindness to your enemies. But you have to practice when they're not around. That's when you build up the force of loving kindness towards your enemies. But what I really wanted to discuss here is the other two aspects of ill will, which is ill will towards yourself, and secondly, ill will towards the meditation object. Ill will towards yourself is the most insidious of these, of this hindrance. And this is one of the major reasons why people don't get into deep meditation, because they don't think they deserve to. I mentioned a story of this Western nun many years ago, who she was talking to me about her meditation, and she got a nimitta coming up, and she was about basically just to go into a deep jhana, but she stopped and she let go completely of the, you know, she receded from the experience because she thought she didn't deserve so much happiness. And it really shocked me at the time when she first told me that she'd given up the opportunity for this wonderful experience because of guilt. This is what guilt does to us. When the word guilt comes up, when the judge says guilty, the next thing which he or she does is to give the sentence. Guilt always is accompanied with punishment. That's why if we've done something wrong, if we've made a mistake, if we're guilty, we want to punish ourselves. And very often, that's by stopping ourselves being happy, by not allowing ourselves happiness. It's so often that if you've got some guilt in the past, something you've done wrong, something you're ashamed of, it actually manifests on a very deep level as your inability to get peaceful in meditation. Even you're so afraid of yourself because of that ill will, you can't even stay in the present moment. Always wandering off into the past or the future, just to escape. So, a wonderful thing to do in this meditation is to do some loving kindness, especially towards yourself. The way I encourage loving kindness towards yourself is using an expression from my own father, who, when I was a 14-year-old child, about 14, took me aside and gave me some very beautiful fatherly advice. When he said to me, he said, "Son, no matter what you ever do in your life, the door of my house will always be open to you." His house was a small, what we call council flat in London. It wasn't much of a house to open to anybody. But I realized it was much more than that he meant. His words were, but what they really meant was, no matter what I ever do in my life, the door of his heart is always open to me. He'd never take away his love. It was unconditional. And that's the way that I've used loving kindness. That's the way I've put it into words, so it could direct me to the deeper meaning of loving kindness. And I say that to myself. No matter what I've ever done in my life, all the stupid jokes, all my mistakes, still the door of my heart is open to me. Come in. So by opening the door of my heart to myself, I'm allowing myself to be happy, no matter what I've done, with all my faults. Allowing yourself to be happy is the way to overcome the hindrance of ill will towards oneself. If you try that in the quietness of your own mind, just in the seclusion of your own room sometimes, just to say to yourself, the door of my heart's open to me, no matter what I've ever done, you're giving yourself the gift of happiness. You're saying it's all right to be happy. I deserve happiness, no matter what I've done. Only when you can overcome so that ill will towards yourself, to let go of all the guilt, only then will you find the meditation can flow smoothly into stillness. Psychologically, you can allow yourself happiness. So if in this meditation you haven't got into deep states of meditation, check that hindrance out. Are you really allowing yourself to be happy? Or are you putting up this deep barrier to yourself? The way to find out is see if you can say those words to yourself with no resistance, with no arguments, with no but. I shouldn't allow myself to be happy. I don't deserve happiness. Other people are okay, but not me. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone makes faults. I said one of my mistakes, one of my big mistakes, the other day about the Sri Lankan people coming for a blessing, and I said, "We're doing it for your mother." And he said, "No, it's for my husband," she pointed out. One of my other big mistakes, one made in my life, very embarrassing. There was in our monastery in Serpentine once, I was just walking through the grounds once, and I found a hammer which was going rusty. And some monk or other had actually left that out in the grass, and it obviously been left out there for quite a few days because it rained and it was going rusty. And I was a senior monk there, so I thought that this actually just isn't on. Now, as a monk, we depend completely on generosity. Everything is offered to us. And many of the people who support our monastery are very poor. And then maybe they just offer like a dollar here or 50 cents there, or they may be not able to offer any funds, but they just come and help for the day. And someone had saved up for this hammer and given it to the monastery so the monks could actually repair and even build some of the structures there. And some stupid and careless monk had been so insensitive as to leave this out in the grass to get wet. This was just not really caring for the generosity of our donors. So that I called a talk, a special talk, for all the monks. and I blasted them. I really sort of gave a very stiff talk. Not like I give here. This was just the monks. And all the monks afterwards, they were sitting dead straight. But there's something which really disappointed me afterwards, even though I sort of really blasted them for like being insensitive and being careless. Not one of those monks, not one of them, came up to me to confess that they left the hammer out in the grass. And I actually felt just so dispirited. Because I thought that, you know, as monks, you know, at least you should be honest and confess your faults. You know, I'll tell you off, but, you know, you wouldn't sort of, not a death sentence. And walking out of the hall feeling just so ashamed of my fellow monks, I just, some of you have heard this story before, I realised why none of them had confessed. Because I suddenly remembered who left the hammer out there in the grass. And of course, you all know it was me. I left the hammer out there. And I'd only remembered after I told everyone else off. I think many of you can relate to things like that. You've done those things as well. So everyone makes mistakes, but you don't feel guilty about it. You don't say that's going to stop your happiness. Because that doesn't help anybody. So allow yourself happiness, no matter what you've ever done. Even Angulimala, the serial killer, he allowed himself happiness in order to become enlightened. Even with all that playing on his mind, if he allowed it to play on his mind, all those people he'd killed. So you can if you want to. So be careful to see whether that's the hindrance which is stopping you getting into deep meditation. Do you really want to be happy? And the other part of the hindrance of ill will is actually ill will towards a meditation object, which is a strange one. This happens to people who have meditated quite a bit. You've meditated often, watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out, sort of with painful knees, with a painful back, hungry, too hot, too cold, really tired, until you associate breath meditation with pain. Here we go again, breathing in, breathing out. I don't want to do this, but Ajahn Brahms, if I do this, I get enlightened one day. Here we go. And that's an extreme form. That's an extreme form of ill will towards the breath. Or ill will towards the present moment. Or ill will just towards meditation. Even when you came in here this morning, did you really want to come in here? Did you really want to come in here and watch your breath? Or was it just, well, I'm here anyway, I might as well get up and I paid for this. So I might as well do it. Are you looking at this retreat like going to the dentist? You know, not really wanting to do it, but seeing that much as something good comes out of this at the end, somewhere maybe, perhaps. Or are you looking at this as like going watching your favourite movie? Do you leap towards meditation as if it was a beautiful piece of music? You just can't wait just to put the CD on and start listening. Is this meditation retreat like going to your favourite restaurant? Where even before you walk in the door, the saliva is coming out. Here we go, the saliva again. Can you feel the saliva now? You see, it went for about 10 or 15 minutes, didn't it? If you look at meditation with ill will, you'll find the mind will do anything except stay with the meditation object. You can't put the mind on the meditation object if you don't love it, if you don't appreciate it, if you're not warm towards it. I've been given this simile of the breath. The same simile can apply to present moment awareness, silence, or loving kindness, whatever else your meditation object is. Imagine you've got a baby, your child. Imagine you go to the shopping mall and you go and buy some things and come home. When you come home, would you actually forget the baby somewhere? Would you actually drop it and say, where's the baby gone? Could you actually leave it at some counter or at the supermarket checkout just because of mindlessness? But that's what you do with the breath, isn't it? We're going to watch the breath, and where's the breath gone? I don't know even where I've left it. Why is it we can't keep watching the breath? Because we don't love it, that's why. We don't really care for it. if you really cared for the breath, if you really loved it, if it was very valuable to you, you'd always be looking after it, looking out for it. And that's why it'd always be there. Imagine you know, because of this retreat, because you were the best meditator, you won the prize of $1,000. Let's call it $10,000. And I gave you $10,000 in cash. On the way home, you'd probably be checking your wallet or your bag every 5 minutes to make sure you haven't left it anywhere. You might leave your sort of your shoes, you might leave your sort of pillowcase here, but you'd never leave $1,000 or $10,000 in this retreat center, would you? Why is that? Because you value it. It's important to you. And if you had valued your breath that much, or valued silence that much, and loved it so much, your mindfulness on that object would increase enormously. The reason why we can't be mindful of the breath is because we don't love it, we don't value it. That's called ill will towards the breath. So in order to oppose or overcome that obstacle to meditation, ill will towards the meditation object, you've got to give the meditation object value. This is important to me. And secondly, to give it some loving kindness. In my meditation, when I get onto the breath, very often that I look upon the breath as like a baby. I give it loving kindness. I already mentioned a little way of doing that yesterday when I described how breath connects you to nature. How you breathe in the oxygen from the trees and the flowers and the grass. How you breathe out the carbon compounds which build up the trees and the flowers. So you have this connection there with nature through the breath. And in this way that you can tend to appreciate and value this breath. You can even look upon it as like a child, a baby. This breath has been looking after you for so many years. It's never complained. It's never asked for anything. So can't you give it a bit of kindness and care? Thank you, breath, for coming in and out of my body all this time. Thank you for giving me the vital oxygen which is necessary for my life. Beautiful breath, thank you for coming to visit me. If you look at the breath like that, with a softness, with a tenderness, with loving kindness, it's just so easy to get the beautiful breath. Because we've overcome the ill will towards the breath. If you have ill will towards the breath, it means you have to hold the breath tightly because part of your mind wants to go somewhere else. You're just doing it out of willpower. I'm going to stay with the breath. I don't really like it, but you've got to do it. That way will never work. You can only effortlessly be with the breath when you've got no ill will towards it, when you value it, when you care for it, when you love it. It's the same with silence. I've got to be silent, but I really want to think. I really want to sort of fantasize. I want to play. And if you do that, you'll find you'll never be able to be with the silence. It's only when you love the silence. And you value it so much, it's so golden, silent, so beautiful. Then it stays all by itself. The reason why you lose the meditation object is because you don't want to be there. You want to be somewhere else. You have ill will. So that's the third part of ill will. Ill will towards the meditation object. So there's three parts of ill will, the second hindrance. Ill will towards another person, which I'm not going into detail because we talk about that a lot. Ill will towards yourself, not allowing yourself happiness, and ill will towards the meditation object. Just a little exercise which is very powerful to overcome ill will towards yourself. If you have a problem with this, then do this little imaginary exercise. With your eyes closed, do this in your own time. Whenever, with your eyes closed, imagine you find an old shoebox. This is just visualization. And it's some wrapping paper close by, and some ribbon. Give yourself the gift of happiness. Put happiness in that box. You don't need to visualize happiness as this, or the other, whatever you want it to be, like a golden light or something, silver or whatever, put happiness in that box. And put the lid on that box. And visualize yourself taking that colored wrapping paper and wrapping it carefully with nice folded ends and getting some sticky tape to stick the ends down and carefully and slowly wrapping the ribbon around that box and finding a little gift card. You know those little gift cards they have? Which you tie to the ribbon and write on that gift card, "To me, with love, from me." And just push that little box aside. This is double imagining now. In your imagination, imagine that you push that box aside and imagine that you find it again. Ah, oh, here's a present for somebody. I wonder who it's for. Imagine yourself inquisitively, with curiosity, looking at the label. Ah, it's to me, with love from me. You know what it's like when you get a present, your heart lifts. And very carefully open up the paper, open the box and see what's inside. And when you open the box, you find inside is a gift of happiness. What I've always wanted. How sweet, how thoughtful. And take it out, it's yours. The purpose of that exercise, and you can put anything in that box, sometimes they give forgiveness or peace. The purpose of that exercise, if you just say forgive yourself, it doesn't work, does it? Because it's only one thought moment. Okay, I forgive myself. You've got to sort of make it a bit more complicated. Because when you make it complicated, make a ritual out of it, it means for the length of time you're imagining this, maybe 5 minutes, well, that 5 minutes you're giving yourself happiness. So psychologically, it does actually impress upon your mind more effectively. So try that for yourself if ever you want forgiveness, or if you want peace, or if you want happiness. Imagine a little box and put it in there. Wrap it up, write a little note to me with love from me. Put it aside and find it again. And you find it works. You actually get some happiness, you get some peace. So that's like another practical way of giving yourself happiness. Overcoming the hindrance of ill will towards yourself. The next hindrance is restlessness and remorse. Sometimes people call it restlessness and worry, but the actual Pali word concerns that particular type of worry, just focused on your faults, things you've done wrong, guilt feelings. The best way of overcoming remorse, you know the best way of overcoming remorse? Is not to do anything bad. So have a good feel, a good precept. Be ethical, be kind, don't be selfish, don't be hurtful. But if you have been hurtful, if you have been stupid, then realize that you are a member of the club called the human race. You make mistakes as everyone else makes mistakes. And the obvious way to overcome those is through acknowledgement, forgiveness, and learning. So if you have remorse, you forgive. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn from that. But with the restlessness, which is more insidious in the meditation, very often that can come along as, say, you're watching the present moment and you want to get on with it. You want to get into the nimittas because you've had nimittas before. We want to get to jhana. This is your last day, so it's jhana or bust today. That restlessness is always going on to something else. Never wanting to be where you are. The Buddha gave this beautiful simile for restlessness of like being a tyrant and you being a slave. Go and get me a cup of tea. Go and sit me down. Go and scratch me. Go and watch the television. Go and get something to eat. Go out to work. Go and clean this. Go and do that. That's what restlessness is. Never letting you sit down still for a moment. Like this tyrannical boss who, as soon as you've finished all your work, gives you a heap more to do. Do you know that tyrannical boss? The biggest tyrant in the world is not Adolf Hitler. It's not sort of Saddam Hussein. It's you. The way you treat yourself is terrible. If the United Nations knew how you treat yourself, you'd be up for war crimes. So that restlessness, the way to overcome that is through contentment. And contentment can only happen amidst imperfection. Being a perfectionist and being restless go together. There's this old story which I told someone the other day. An old Zen story about this gardener had this amazing Zen garden. And it was one of the most famous in Japan, and people would come from all over the place to admire his garden. And one day an old meditation monk came to look at this garden. He arrived very early in the morning, before the garden was open. And he just watched this gardening monk. This gardening monk would get up very early in the morning with two baskets, and in the garden was this big cherry tree. He would pick up all the leaves and the twigs which had fallen the night before. But before putting them in the basket, he would examine them carefully. If they were the right shape, if they were aesthetically pleasing, he put it in one basket. If they weren't, he put it in the rubbish basket. After 2 or 3 hours of collecting and examining each leaf and twig, he'd take the rubbish leaves and twigs around the back of the temple for the compost. And the good leaves, he would spend another 2 or 3 hours placing them one by one around the cherry tree. And he had such a wonderful artistic sense. He's one of these gifted people that when he was finished, the effect was awesome. It was really amazing. And only half he finished, but he opened up the garden so the visitors could also admire his work. And when this meditation monk sort of saw that the gardening monk had finished, he came up to him and said, "I've been watching you, you know, all morning, and I'm so impressed with your diligence and how careful you have been." He said, "Your garden's almost perfect." And at those words, it was like an electric shock had gone up the back of this gardening monk. He straightened up and he trembled in his speech. He said, "What do you mean, almost perfect?" And he fell down on his knees and he bowed to this old meditation monk. He said, "Please, wise master, out of compassion for me and all my visitors, please tell me how I can make my garden absolutely perfect." And the meditation master said, "Do you really want me to tell you?" He said, "Yes, oh please, be compassionate, oh wise one." So the old meditation monk went to the center of the garden and put his arms around the tree and shook the hell out of it. And twigs and litter went all over the place. And when the garden was a right mess, the meditation master smiled and said, "Now that's perfect." And that's a lovely story, because the only way, for those of you who've got a garden or a house, the only way you can get a bit of time is to be able to say, even though the dishes need washing, even though the lawn needs mowing, even though the leaves need raking, it's perfect. Not now. Otherwise, you'd always be restless. You'd always be doing something. If you try and get everything out of the way before you meditate. Did you get everything out of the way before you came here? Of course you didn't. I didn't. There's still lots of things I didn't do at my monastery before I came here. You never get everything out of the way. Actually, there's one time you get everything out of the way. When you die. That's the only time you'll be finished. But the restlessness is always doing something. And we think we have to do it. We think these things need to be done. Do they really, really need to be done? And the other story I like to tell is a beautiful story of a monk in Thailand. He was building his hall in his monastery. When it came to the monsoons, the rains retreat. The roof wasn't on, the windows weren't on. And there's lots of building material all over the place. And one of his supporters came and asked quite casually, he said, "When's your hall going to be finished?" And the monk equally casually said, "It is finished." And the man looked at him and said, "What do you mean it's finished? You haven't got a roof on it yet. There's no windows. There's no even doors in the door holes. And the place is a mess. What do you mean it's finished?" And the monk said, "What's done is finished." And that's a very beautiful saying. What's done is finished. So all of your work, what's done is finished. It means you can let go. But please don't tell that to your children who are studying. Because I got into trouble with this when I told this story one evening at... in our city centre in Damaloka in Perth. And the next few days, some of the parents came up to me and said, our sons were listening to your talk. When I asked them, how's your homework? They said, Ajahn Brahm said, what's that is finished. I'm going to be in trouble with the parents. But with restlessness, the way to overcome it is being content. And the only way to be content is within imperfection. Anyone could be content with perfection. When everything is absolutely perfect, of course you can be content with perfection. But if you're waiting for perfection to happen, you'll never find that contentment, because perfection isn't there. So you have to be content with imperfection. When you're in watching present moment awareness, this moment will be imperfect. There'll always be someone coughing or sneezing. There'll always be someone who opens the door and at the same time someone's in the toilet next door. There'll always be sort of a fly coming in and going onto your face, not the person sitting next to you. There'll always be some sort of indigestion. So, this is life. So, restlessness is when we just cannot be content here. And then we go off looking for something else, somewhere else. Contentment is what makes you move from where you are. So discontent, restlessness. And the only way to overcome that restlessness is to develop contentment. Contentment, contentment, contentment. In the present moment, okay, this is not the best meditation center or the best retreat center. This is not your best body. This is good enough. So be content with this. It's all you have. The silence. Sure, you can say things about it, but just be content. When you're content, there's no need to say anything or think anything. All thinking comes from discontent. The breath. It might not be the most beautiful breath. It might be sort of hard to breathe. You might have some hay fever or asthma. It's good enough. Be content with this breath, with this moment, with silence. When you get to nimittas, it doesn't matter what colour they are, whether they're bright, whether just be content with it. Don't try and get rid of it to get onto something else. Contentment is the way into deep meditation. It's because of discontent, some subtle discontent, that we kind of get quiet. We're just not happy, we want to get to jhanas. We're just on the breath, but we don't want the breath, we want the jhanas. Jhanas will never come that way. What I've been saying here is very important. I'll say it once again. The next stage lies within the stage you're in now. Jhanas lie within the nimitta. So don't be discontent with the nimitta. Just be absolutely content with the nimitta. You don't want anything else in the whole world. You're just so happy just to be with this nimitta. And then jhanas will emerge by themselves from the very center. When you're just with a beautiful breath, don't worry about the nimitta. Just be content to have a beautiful breath. You're just so happy just being there. The nimitta will come out right from the very center of that beautiful breath. Don't worry about getting a beautiful breath. When's that going to happen to me? If you start thinking like that, you're discontent with the ordinary breath you've got now. If you're discontent with the ordinary breath, a beautiful breath will never arise. So you develop enormous contentment with just this ordinary breath you have. And the breath changes all by itself into beauty. Just be absolutely content with silence. Don't even worry about the breath. The breath will come up all by itself when it's ready. Be absolutely content with present moment awareness. Just happy to be present. The first stage, the meditation. I don't care if I get to jhanas. I don't care. Absolutely content with the present moment. And silence will come all by itself. It's because of discontent, trying to get on with things, that people fail in their meditation. Patience is the only way. It's the fastest way. Through letting go. So be careful with that restlessness of the mind. Especially when you get to the last stage of the meditation. The hindrance of ill will and sensory desire disappear before you get to the nimittas. But the last hindrance to go is restlessness. Even with a nimitta. That's where the nimitta doesn't stay still. The reason why the nimitta doesn't stay still is because the one who's watching isn't staying still. Still doing things. Still looking backwards and forwards. If you move like this, moving your head backwards and forwards when you're watching looking in a mirror, you find the image in the mirror also moves. What a stupid person does, they see the image in the mirror moving, they try and hold the mirror still. That doesn't make things stop. As long as the person looking is moving, the image will be moving. The limiter is the image of your mind. If that mind, the observer, is watching, is moving, so will the limiter. You can try and hold that glass, that experience, but you just make things move even more. You just got to absolutely let go, not moving. So the last hindrance to go is that subtle restlessness, which stops the mind going into the deepest jhana. The next hindrance is sloth and torpor. Of all the hindrances, that's the one you least need to worry about. You'd be very happy to hear that, I think. Because sloth and torpor, you're getting peaceful, only you're not there to enjoy it when it happens. Sloth and torpor are obstacles which great meditators experience from time to time. Mahamoggallana, who is the right-hand disciple of the Buddha, before he was enlightened, he had so much sloth and torpor. The Buddha came to him and said, "Moggallana, you're nodding, you're going to sleep." He said yes. And a couple of days later, he was fully enlightened. Another story from the suttas, which might encourage you, was the Buddha was walking with Ananda on the edge of the forest. He saw this monk sitting dead straight in meditation. And he turned to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about that monk. I think he will disrobe soon." And he did. He went deeper into the forest and he saw another monk who was sitting in meditation, nodding backwards and forwards, sloth and torpor. And the Buddha smiled. "I'm not worried about that monk. He'll be enlightened soon." And he was. That's fascinating, isn't it? The hardest thing to do is to give up the thinking. Give up the restlessness. When you've given that up, and at least you can go to sleep when you're meditating, at least it means you're not attached to the thinking, you're not attached to the body, you're not worried about things. You've actually gone a long way in meditation. It's true. People don't believe me. It's amazing. But it's true. You only have to go a little bit further to be a bit more alert, which is not that hard to do. And you can let go of the body, let go of your concerns, and also be there when it happens and get into deep meditations. What actually is happening with sloth and torpor? There are two parts of the mind. I call them the doer and the knower. The knower is the screen, what experiences all these words and visions and thoughts, and what's hearing all of this. That's the knower. And the doer is what reacts to this. What is will, what moves the mind or the body. The knower and the doer. In meditation, this is a knower, this is a doer. You want to calm the doer down. Stop doing things. And just know. However, that these two, knower and doer, are usually so close together with most people, we don't know really how to separate them. What we know, we do. What we do, we know. That when we try and calm one down, the other one calms down as well. The doer and the knower both disappear. And that's called sloth and torpor. At least we know how to let go of the doer. Now, let go of the doer, but keep the knower alert. Keep mindfulness clear. So the doer disappears, but the knower is very alert. And one of the ways to do that is, again, to see the beauty in these beautiful states. When you're experiencing beauty, you don't feel sleepy. In Thailand, once a week, we used to stay up all night meditating. Not sleeping during the day, not sleeping at night. And used to get very sleepy. And very tired, a lot of sloth and torpor. Then I started to think after a few months of this. I was only a young monk. I remembered about a year or two before, as a layman, I used to go to all-night parties. Now, every time I went to an all-night party or an all-night concert, I never got sleepy at all. What was the difference? When I was meditating, I was sleepy, but when I was at a party, I wasn't. The difference was I was enjoying myself at a party. And I was getting dull because I had no fun in my meditation. It wasn't enjoyable anymore. I wasn't putting the joy into it. As soon as I put joy into the meditation, then everything began to sparkle. You didn't feel so sleepy. Even here, I don't know how much you are sleeping. Some of you are tired, but the sleepiness should start to be going. The more you enjoy yourself while you're here, the less you want to sleep. Prisoners used to tell me, one of the sayings in jail is, an hour extra sleep is an hour off the sentence. Because they weren't having fun at all in jail. But if you're on holiday, enjoying yourself, then you want to get your money's worth. Every moment is important. So look at that. If you have lots of happiness and joy, you just do not want to sleep. Sometimes you get into these deep meditations, you're just buzzing with so much happiness, you can't go to sleep. You just meditate all night, and just no worries at all. It's because of the happiness, the piti sukha in the mind. And this happens naturally. There's nothing wrong with this, it's just a part of the experiences in meditation. So sloth and torpor come because there's not enough happiness with what you're doing. But it's not a big problem. That will just come after a little while. The last of the hindrances, because I'm running out of time, is doubt. Doubt is again on many things. It can be doubt to the teachings, whether, you know, this is really a good path of meditation. Doubt into whether doubt the teachings, doubt of the teacher. But the most important doubt is a doubt about oneself. I can't really do this. I can't get into jhanas. You have to be a monk to get into jhanas. Or, you know, some people say that the only time you can get enlightened was just after the time of the Buddha, and this age is a dark age and no one can get enlightened anymore. That's a really waste of time. All you can do is like make merit, that's all. So you should be home enjoying yourself and just making more money so you can make more merit. As soon as you think like that, it's self-fulfilling. You can't achieve anything. I'm sure that each one of you knows enough about motivational psychology that if you think you can, then it's possible. As soon as you think you can't, then it's completely impossible. So be careful to motivate yourself. That's why I say here that according to the Buddha's teachings, the only people who can't get jhanas, who can't get enlightened, are those people who killed their parents or created a schism in the Sangha. Or now the Buddha's long gone, you can't actually draw the blood of a Buddha or do any of these other things which stop you being enlightened. Angulimala, serial killer, could get enlightened, get into jhanas. Have we got any serial killers here? This retreat? Prostitutes would join a Sangha and become enlightened, even with that lifestyle. People who'd lost their patachari, who'd lost her husband, her two children, and her parents all on the same day, completely traumatized, she could get enlightened. Street sweepers, hardly any education, they could get enlightened. As well as highly educated people, everyone could get enlightened. 120-year-old men once got enlightened. Women, men from all races, all classes. So never think, I can't. It's only I haven't yet. One of the jobs of a teacher is to be a coach. And the coach of a sports team or a sports person, their job is to encourage that person to say, it doesn't matter how famous or how successful your opponent is, that you can win, you can beat them, you can achieve. And a good coach is a person who can actually convince that team or that person under them that they can defeat someone even better than them. And that's why you do get these amazing coaches. Like, for example, that coach who coached the women's hockey team, Rick Charlesworth, because he's in Western Australia. You know, I'm sure the women's hockey players in Australia are not all that much better than hockey players in other places in the world. They've just got this amazing coach who I think for 2 or 3 years running has won the Olympic gold medal for the hockey team. He just inspires people, just says, you can win, you can win, you will win, you do win. And a coach like that is worth so much. And this is my job, to coach you, to say, yes, you can get into jhanas. You will get into jhanas. There's nothing between you and these jhanas. Go for it. And as soon as you talk like that, it makes it possible. So the doubt, I'm sure everyone else is getting to jhanas, but not me, because I wasn't even born a Buddhist. And I've got so many problems in my life, and I don't make dana. I don't even keep five precepts. I'm really hopeless. I'll never do these things. As soon as you put an obstacle in your way, then it becomes an obstacle. Don't have that doubt, the doubt I can't do. Even if you've been meditating for years, you just haven't been able to watch the breath, you know, even for more than 1 minute, and all these years you've been meditating. Don't let that give rise to doubt. I can't do. Just say, I haven't done yet. But the next moment, you might. And actually, what happens in meditation? This is honest from a teacher of meditation, that people sometimes, they think they're getting nowhere, they're getting nowhere, they're getting nowhere. And then suddenly they just press the right buttons, and they're there. They can't believe it. They can do it as well. I gave this in my little book about going to work. You go to work on Monday, you work really hard. And at the end of the day, you get nothing. Just the boss tells you, thank you very much, see you again tomorrow. On Tuesday, it's the same. You work really hard all day. At the end of the day, nothing to show for it. Except some few blisters and tiredness. Wednesday and Thursday is the same. You get nothing, but just for some reason or other, you go to work Friday as well. You work exactly the same, no more, no less than all the other days. But on Friday evening, the boss gives you a check. You think, wow, why can't, at last I've got it right. Why can't every day be Friday, payday? In the assembly, you meditate and you meditate and meditate, you never get anywhere. You think, what am I doing this for? And then suddenly you meditate, you do exactly the same things, and wow, you get sort of nimittas, jhanas, everything is wonderful. You think, wow, at last I know it. And the next time you meditate, nothing again. You think, why can every day be payday? And that's a good simile, because the reason why you get paid on Friday is not just what you've done on Friday, it's because what you've done on Thursday, Wednesday, Tuesday, and Monday as well. You get the paycheck, a nice beautiful meditation, because all of those so-called bad meditations which went before, they're all so important. That's where you do the work. And the good meditations is where you get the paycheck. So that's why one of my meditation teachers told a very profound thing. There's no such thing as a bad meditation. Just because you don't get paid doesn't mean the work is not valued or valuable. There's no such thing as a bad meditation. Every meditation is worthwhile. If you keep on going, eventually you get the paycheck and get the beautiful meditations. So don't have the doubt in yourself or the doubt in the teachings. This has been going for 25 centuries. It's been tried and tested all that time, and it works. It's just a matter of time before it works for you. So those are the five hindrances. Sensory desire, which is concern for this rotten old body, which is always sneezing or coughing or doing something wrong. Concern about the ill will, especially towards yourself or towards the meditation object. Restlessness and remorse, especially the restlessness because of just a lack of contentment. Always remember that word contentment. Such a powerful word in meditation. It's a cause of letting go. And sloth and torpor, that's not a big thing at all. Sleep if you want to. I don't care about that one. But I know you'll get through that easily by yourself. The other ones are the problems. And the last one is doubt. Have that confidence, I can do this. Have that confidence, this is a good path. Cheer yourself up. Make it possible. And it does become possible. So those are five hindrances. If you have any problem in the meditation, any problem whatsoever, try and look at that in terms of those five hindrances. Which one is it? Usually there is a major one. Deal with that one first, and then the smaller ones you can deal with afterwards. Last little simile. If there is one hindrance which keeps on reappearing again and again and again and again, now your hindrance, your problem, remember the simile of the snake. The simile of the snake goes like this. When I was in Thailand, in the jungles, very often we didn't have sandals. The sandals broke very easily and we couldn't get new ones for sometimes weeks. So you had to walk barefoot. Sometimes you even have batteries for the flashlights, so you just have to guide yourself by the stars or the moon. Through the jungle, where there were heaps and heaps of snakes. You used to have this saying in Thailand, there were 100 species of snake, and 99 were venomous, poisonous, and the other ones strangled you to death. They're all deadly. And so you had to walk barefoot through the jungle at night time with no flashlight, when you knew there were snakes about. Because I was looking out for the snakes, I'd always see them. And I'd either make a detour around them or step over them or make sure that they couldn't bite me. Because I was on the lookout. Sometimes if I'd have had a flashlight and big boots, I probably would have been so secure that I probably wouldn't even looked. It doesn't really matter. But because I was so vulnerable, I looked very carefully. And that's why I was never bitten. In this simile, this snake, your snake, is your favorite hindrance. When you start meditation, know it's there, waiting for you, somewhere on the path. And it's bitten you so many times. If you're on the lookout for it, you know it's around, you'll see it before it can come in striking distance. And you'll take evasive action. Whether it's sloth and torpor or restlessness, if that's your most important worry, most important hindrance, be wary of it. Set up mindfulness to say, look out for this one. And if you're on the lookout for it, you'll see it always in plenty of time. Here it comes, you notice it, and you can avoid it. If it's thinking, if that's your biggest hindrance, be careful, say to yourself at the beginning of the meditation. I've lost my meditation so often through too much thinking. I'm going to be on the lookout for it this time. And when thinking starts, you can notice it straight away, and you can stop it very easily when it's the first thought. In the same way, you can pull out a little sapling very easy, just with your two fingers. But when it's a huge tree, when you're too late, you have to get bulldozers sometimes to dig it out. So remember the simile of the snake. Find out what your biggest hindrance is. You start meditating, tell yourself to look out for that one, and you'll avoid it before it strangles you. Hindrances. Any questions about that before we go off and do the next thing? Yeah?
Just on that last one, maybe at the bulldozer metaphor.
Yeah.
Myself, I believe I've got a very ingrained bad habit. Should that mean that I should do the bulldozer and knock them over?
No.
Act more gently.
No, always act gently. Those ingrained bad habits that they're not all that much ingrained. If you believe they are ingrained, they become ingrained. You can change at any time. It's an amazing thing about the mind. If you can really let go of the past, you're free from all the bad habits. So don't believe that that's a habitual pattern for you. Just be on the lookout for it, and you can change straight away. It's mindfulness, that awareness which spots these things, which can stop old habits and create new ones. You've heard me say, those in BSV have heard me say this before, even when you're on the retreats here, sometimes it's convenient always to sit in the same place. Sometimes, I've got no choice because I have to be up here, but sometimes it's good to sit in different places, to do things differently, not to go to work the same route every morning. Even to the point, this is something you can practice when you're here, when you brush your teeth in the morning, what side of the mouth do you start first of all? Is it always sort of, the top left-hand corner or the top right-hand corner? Tomorrow morning, start a different place in the mouth. And the morning afterwards, start somewhere completely different again. Change it around. It takes more mindfulness to do that, more alertness. It's a creature of habit. You do it automatically. You don't need to think. And sometimes, you just don't know really what you're doing. You become a creature of habit that way. But mindfulness gives you alternatives, different ways of doing things. So try and be someone who just stops just always doing things automatically like a robot. Don't always eat the same food. Don't always do it the same way. Don't become a creature of routines. And if you can do that, you find it's easy to give up even psychological habits. Mindfulness gives you alternatives. gives you like a different door to go through. And that way it's not ingrained anymore. Does that make sense? Okay, so I think that's enough.